So where the hell is he? He's hiding somewhere in the past or the future, I said. There's really only one way to get to the bottom of what happened to Jim. No one spoke for a minute, all of us doubtlessly thinking the same thing. No, said Martha, shaking her head. No. It's out of the question, Bea. No. It's not as dangerous as you think, I said. Yes, it is. I did it already. I went back even farther, 5 years by accident. The crazy thing about the past is that you never meet yourself. There are no doubles. If you arrive there, your past self exits on cue to make room for you. Martha looked furious. How long are your wakes now? I shrugged. Ours are only 4 hours. She shook her head. They're getting shorter and shorter, and it's getting worse. Every time we go into the past or future, it makes the possibility of a unanimous vote even more impossible. Don't you get it? She snapped this at me so furiously, eyes bulging, glasses going crooked on the end of her nose. I could only stare back in shock. We all did. She fell silent, seemingly embarrassed by her outburst. Kipling turned to me. How long is your wake now? 6 hours? It's enough time to try, isn't it? Martha said nothing, staring sullenly at the floor. If we arrive at Vulcanation at 1 in the morning, I said, even if your wake is 4 hours or 3, I'm almost positive it will give us enough time to see what happened to Jim. With a pang of queasiness, I thought back to his last text. Sent at 11:29 p.m. I'm going to the quarry. Meet me. They still didn't know about the texts from Jim. I wasn't going to tell them. Let's do it, said Whitley. As the rest of us talked about the logistics of changing the wake, Martha stayed silent, slumped way down in the couch cushions, her expression a mixture of resentment and hopelessness. It appeared my suggestion of venturing once and for all to Vulcan Quarry was flying in the face of her grand plan. It had made her lose control of the group, though what she was so anxious about, and what this meant for the vote, I could only imagine. Chapter 23. When I woke, I was staring at a clear night sky filled with stars, the deafening screech of crickets in my ears. I was lying in thick grass, the long, razor-like blade slicing my bare arms. I was wearing my Darrow uniform. I lifted my head, realizing with a rush of relief that I was outside the quarry, though almost immediately relief gave way to suffocating dread. The rusted chain-link fence was only a few feet away. I checked my watch. It was 1:02 a.m. I crawled to my feet, dizzy, and looked around. There was no sign of anyone. I groped my way along the fence, kicking back the grass, the gnarled coils of brambles sharp as barbed wire. Ahead I could see the rusted yellow sign, "No trespassing." Somewhere near was the hole we'd always used. I bent down, forcing aside the weeds, fumbling along the ground. I found the hole and crawled through. Far ahead, suspended in the sky, I could see the foreman's lookout. I shivered, trying to ignore the nausea rising in my throat. The old wood tower looked like an abandoned space station in the dark.
Bea!
Hissed a voice behind me. I whipped around. Whitley was waving at me from the other side of the fence. Kipling was behind her, his head barely visible above the ocean of grass. I directed them toward the opening, and within seconds they were beside me. "Where's Martha?" I asked. "Missing," said Kipling, scrambling to his feet.
"What?"
"She bailed."
"One second she was there," said Whitley, shaking her head. "The next, nowhere."
"She never wanted to come," said Kipling. "So she didn't."
We eyed each other, unsettled at the thought.
Where had she gone? Was she hiding out like Cannon somewhere in the past or future, terrified of what we were about to discover? There were so many questions, but there was no time to figure them out. Not now.
We need a hiding place, I whispered.
There's that cement pipe in the grass next to the entry to the mining shafts. We could stay there.
Whitley frowned.
What about the old mapping office right beside the road? I shook my head. Too obvious. Jim might see us. Then we'll have interfered with the past, and we won't find out what actually happened.
Cement pipe it is, said Kipling with a cryptic grin.
We took off, fighting our way through the grass to reach the quarry road. Little was left of it, apart from bits of rock and gravel, and the grass there was only knee-high. As we headed down the path, I noticed after a minute that Kipling was lagging far behind, an oddly bleak look on his face. When he saw I was waiting for him, he glanced up, feigning a smile. "Are you all right?" I asked.
"Oh, sure, child, splendid. It isn't every day I get to watch one of my friends get murdered."
I put my arm around him for reassurance, pulling him beside me as we trudged on, fighting back the fronds, the wail of the crickets so deafening it sounded like a million knives being sharpened in my ears. Yet the question blinked glaringly in my mind. How did he know Jim was murdered? He'd blurted it without thinking. As if he knew. As we walked on, Kipling seemed unconcerned about his disclosure, which made me wonder if it had actually been one. Did he know something? Or was he only giving voice to his suspicion that someone came out here tonight to kill Jim? Within minutes, we had reached the center of Vulcanation, where the old quarry road made an elongated U past the mapping office, the outhouses, the foreman's lookout. The lookout was held aloft by four massive steel legs reinforced with criss-crossing beams, the wood ladder stretching up the center like an old arthritic backbone. There were a few more structures dotting the road, lodging for the miners, little more than heaps of rotten pine logs, and a collapsed crane which looked like the remains of a great blue whale. The three of us paused, looking around, apprehensive. It was totally overgrown and wild, more than I remembered. The tempo of the cricket's screeching began to quicken as if it were the pulse of the night itself, terrified, on edge. There didn't appear to be anyone here. Not Jim. Not anyone. Suddenly, a wave of nausea came over me, and I was sick all over the ground. "Poor Bee," said Whitley, brushing away the hair stuck to my cheek. "Maybe we should forget all this and go back." I shook my head. "I'll be fine." Ignoring her worried glance, I stepped past her into the grass. It took a few minutes for us to find the cement pipe, some 30 feet long, only a few feet from the edge of the quarry. As I stepped toward the precipice, I was afraid the ground would start to crumble underneath me, but it held. I stared out, my chest tightening from the shock of how abruptly the ground gave way to total nothingness. It was a 300-foot drop, the crater stretching out, a stadium of rock, a vast sky littered with stars, and far below the lake, dark water glistening in the moonlight.
"Sister B," whispered Kip, stepping up beside me. "I have a funny feeling death will be like this."
His voice, eerily flat, sent a surge of fear through me. I wondered numbly if he was about to push me in.
"It'll feel like falling, but on and on, never stopping. You know?"
He was staring at me with a thin little smile. I swallowed, barely able to breathe.
"Look," said Whitley.
Turning, I saw she was leaning against the pipe, pointing at something. High in the wooden tower of the lookout, a tiny green light was visible in a window. It belonged to the oil lamp some student had smuggled up there years earlier. None of us spoke. The conclusion was obvious. Someone had been up there. Or they were up there now.
"I'll go see who it is," said Whitley.
"No," I said.
"Why not?"
I want to see if it's Jim.
He'll see you. If you interfere, we won't know what really happened. Then let me just see if I can find his bike.
Don't! I grabbed her arm.
Bee, what's the matter with... Stop it!
She yanked it loose, about to take off. But suddenly the sound of someone yards away fighting a path through the brush made her stop dead. None of us moved as we watched the top of a dark head bobbing toward us. It was Jim. A wave of horror choked me. The grass trembled and shook. Martha stepped out. We gaped at her. Her neon blue hair was gone. She was her old self from Darrow, dark hair and a careless ponytail, oversized Oxford shirt.
"What hole did you just crawl out of?" asked Kipling.
"We thought you ditched us," said Wit.
"Yeah, sorry about that." She adjusted her glasses. "For some reason, I think it was because I was thinking of the map of the entire quarry before the wake. I ended up waking not by the south fence with you guys, but by the east fence behind the pancake house. I had to hike the mile along the quarry road to get here."
She took a deep breath.
"Seen anything yet?"
"Only that light," said Whitley, indicating the foreman's lookout.
Martha squinted up at it. She seemed unsurprised.
"Did you see anyone along the road?" I asked her.
She shook her head. It was then that I noticed she was drenched in sweat. Her shirt clung to her. Her hair was plastered to her forehead. Walking along the quarry road wouldn't have exerted her to that extent. She was lying. Noticing my stare, she smiled thinly and slipped past me to the pike, wiping her forehead.
"Now what?" she whispered.
"Now we wait and see," I said, moving beside her. The car arrived at 1:30. We heard it coming before we saw it. A loose hubcap, radio blaring. The four of us fell silent, standing shoulder to shoulder along the pipe. Gold headlights swept across the grass. Then a red Nissan slowly rounded the quarry road, bouncing and clanging along the uneven ground before stopping right beside the foreman's lookout. I couldn't see who was driving, though I could make out a for sale sign in the back window.
"Vita Joshua?" whispered Whitley, incredulous.
The engine idled, white moths whirling in the headlights. The radio switched off. There was a moment of silence. Then the driver's door opened, and someone climbed out. When I saw who it was, chills electrocuted my spine.
Cannon.
He dressed in jeans, his old gray hacker's hoodie. He fought through the grass and disappeared into the old mapping office, a sagging shed with a tin roof, though after a minute he reemerged, agitated. He clambered back to the car, texted someone, waited for a response, crossing and uncrossing his arms. As I watched him, I wondered how Cannon of all people had come to be driving Mr. Joshua's car, a car that usually remained parked behind the music school when Vita wasn't using it. Then I remembered how he and Whitley had always stolen things around campus. He had stolen the car to drive out here to meet someone.
"Hello?" Cannon called. "Anybody here?"
No one answered. He moved to the front of the car and sat on the hood, staring meditatively into the headlights. Another 10 minutes, and he was furious. He looked around, scowling, then seemed to give up and climbed behind the wheel, slamming the door, radio blasting heavy metal. He tried to pull away, but the wheels were caught in the grass, the tires spinning. He put the car in reverse, and it bumped backward a few feet. He hit the gas harder, and the car roared back, hitting something. Cannon inched the car forward, then reversed again. The car jerked, smashing whatever it was, bouncing over it and stalling. Cannon climbed out. He crouched down to check under the tires. He stood up immediately, then he bent down again. Then he stood up. He bent down a third time.
"No, no,"
No. No, no.
Cannon threw his head back and began to howl.
No, no, no!
Bewildered, I glanced over at Martha, Kipling, and Whitley watching the scene in silence beside me. They seemed as puzzled as I was. Muttering something, Cannon bent down once more, seemingly trying to wrench whatever he had run over out from under the tires. For minutes, all we could see were shaking grasses. When he stood up again, he was making a strange noise, as if he was crying. That was when I caught sight of what was in his hand. A tweed cap. It was Jim's. No, this can't be happening. Cannon was back behind the wheel. After a few tries, he managed to back out, doing a 3-point turn. He was about to drive away, it seemed, only he had second thoughts, because the car jolted to a halt and he climbed out again. He stood frozen for a moment, as if in a trance. Then he stepped over to what he had pulled out from under the wheels. What I could see now, in a rush of disbelief, of horror, as I scrambled on top of the pipe for a better look, was no log. It was Jim, my Jim, lying on his side. His jeans were streaked with blood. Cannon was cradling Jim's head in his lap. Cannon bent over him, whispering something, and then he was on his feet again, on the phone.
Call me. I need you to come. I need you to help me. Now. Please call me back. Please, please.
He said it over and over, his voice a high-pitched whine. It was terrible to witness. Cannon's resolute action, his ease with problem-solving, his unflappable tenaciousness, all of which had come to define him in my mind the way waves define the ocean, clouds the sky. It was gone now. He was a different person.
I need you. I need you now. Please come, please.
Whoever he was calling, no one answered. Cannon climbed into the driver's seat again, sitting in pitch darkness, engine running, radio on. 15 minutes later, when he finally emerged, he had a plan. He was his old self, the fixer. He grabbed Jim's ankles and began to pull him brutally through the grass, cursing as Jim lost a loafer, crying out in disbelief, in despair, before wiping his face in the crook of his arm and continuing on. He reached the quarry's edge. It was yards away from where we were watching. He threw Jim into the quarry without saying a prayer, without hesitation. There was the hushed whir of the body falling, knocking against rocks, and then nothing. The muted splash of Jim hitting the water lost in the shriek of crickets. Cannon stared after him, immobile, his blank face hollowed by shadows. I wondered if he was considering going in with Jim, ending it all right then and there. Instead, he turned with an empty stare, climbed into the car, and drove off. It was a moment before any of us could move. I was standing on top of the pipe in the dark, my heart pounding, my mind short-circuiting. Too late, I realized the cement was cracking under my feet. Abruptly, with an angry belch, the entire thing collapsed, Martha and the others jumping back into the grass as I was sent plummeting into the pile of rubble. Whit helped me, gasping to my feet.
What the hell was that? Are you okay?
I nodded, climbing out, dusting myself off. We stood silently in a circle for a moment, eyeing each other in shock.
But who did Cannon call?
Whispered Whit with a hint of indignation.
Because it wasn't me. I never knew any of this.
He called Kipling, said Martha. We turned to Kip. He eyed us stiffly, guiltily, his arms held at odd angles at his side.
She's right, he whispered. The devil called and I answered.
He said it flatly, with a hint of relief, and I remembered with a shiver of shock the meaningful glance I'd seen Kip exchange with Cannon back in the Wincroft library when they were confessing how Kipling had made it through Darrow. They hadn't been thinking about the arrangement Cannon had made, or the cheating. They'd been thinking about this very night, and the secret they kept.
"I helped him throw Jim's body into the quarry," said Kipling.
We stared at him.
"How can that be?" asked Whitley. "We didn't see you."
Chapter 39, The Bend, whispered Martha.
"You never run into yourself in the past or the future."
Kipling nodded.
"I had to come here. I had to watch. I had to know, once and for all, if it had been my idea to throw Jim into the lake or Cannon's.
Would it happen if I wasn't a part of it?
I had to know who was the bad one and who was worse."
"Did Cannon tell you why he had come here?"
Martha asked and bit her lip.
"He did."
"What did he say?"
Kipling smiled demurely.
"Why don't you ask her?"
He nodded at Whitley. She glared at him, livid. For a moment I thought she was about to start screaming, unleashing one of her rages. Instead, she sighed.
"Cannon was my best customer," she said.
"What are you talking about?"
I whispered.
"Adderall. The White Rabbit gave him his boundless supply. He popped them like Tic Tacs. He still does."
"All that time during school, he never knew you were the White Rabbit?"
asked Martha.
Witt shook her head.
"Not until Vita. I was too scared to tell him."
I thought back to Cannon's reaction when he'd learned Witt was the White Rabbit. He had been livid. Now I understood why. It was because she had known his secret all along and had never told him hers.
"So let me get this straight," said Martha. "On the night Jim died, Cannon called the White Rabbit for another stash of Adderall, and you sent him out here."
Whitley nodded, sullen.
"Why here?"
Whit shook her head. "Jim had found me out a few weeks before. He was watching me constantly, telling me I had to stop. I was afraid to do a drop on campus, so I decided out here was perfect. It was remote. I texted Cannon as the White Rabbit, telling him he could find his supply inside a desk in the mapping office. Only I couldn't make it out here in time. I got caught talking to Mrs. Lampanetti about my Italian final. I raced back to the quarry and did the drop, but I had no further contact that night from Cannon."
"When did you make it back here?" asked Martha.
"It was 3 in the morning. I didn't see anything or anyone, I swear to God."
"You must have just missed them."
Martha checked her watch.
"When Jim turned up dead at the quarry, you must have suspected Cannon. After all, you knew he'd come out here."
Whit nodded.
"But I knew he'd never willingly hurt Jim."
Martha turned, staring up at the foreman's lookout.
"So the only question now is..."
She fell silent, nibbling a fingernail.
"What?"
prompted Kipling.
"How did Jim appear so suddenly under that car?"
She turned on her heel, resolved.
"Come," she ordered. Beckoning us to follow her, she vanished into the grass.
Chapter 24. When we caught up to Martha, she was crouching underneath the foreman's lookout. Staring overhead, I saw in astonishment that the ladder to climb up was missing. I realized then that what remained of it was strewn all over the ground.
"Incredible!"
Martha gasped in shock over some revelation, then stood up, shaking her head.
"It's really the most impossible sequence of events."
"What?" asked Kipling.
"Mama Greer was right."
"About?"
"The freak possible."
Martha rolled one of the pieces of wood under her sneaker, then gazed up at the landing suspended high over our heads.
Poor Jim.
She looked at me, and instantly I felt chills inching up my arms. What was she aiming at? What was she trying to do? It was dark, but her eyes sparkled behind her glasses, alert, alive. It happened right here, she said. Jim was undone over Beatrice confronting him about his lie the night he went off with Vita. He was also distraught over Estella Ornato. His perfect life had fallen down around him, so he escaped here, as he often did, to be alone, to write music. He started to climb up to the foreman's lookout, but the ladder gave out. He managed to grab a few supporting beams, trying to save himself, but they didn't hold. Martha bent down to inspect a piece of the wood, showing us that the underside was completely rotten. He fell. It was a considerable distance, 5-6 stories, a drop that would have killed most people. Yet Jim survived.
How?
I whispered. He was drunk. It's why drunk drivers survive car accidents. Drunks don't tense up on impact, they relax. That saves their lives. He was unconscious for an hour, maybe two. Then he woke up. She squinted out at the quarry road. He must have heard the car or seen the headlights, or maybe he was just trying to get to his bike. Martha hurried to the other side of the road and dragged Jim's bike out of the grass, throwing it at our feet with the flair of a magician whisking a rabbit from a hat. He crawled from here to here. She pointed toward the road. That's 8-10 feet. He was trying to get help. At that point, Cannon had climbed behind the wheel again. If Jim called out, it was lost in the crickets, the engine, the radio. We couldn't hear a thing or see much in the dark. Neither did Cannon. Cannon, assuming the white rabbit stood him up, has to get back to school, drive the car back before Moses returns to the gatehouse after his AA meeting. Frustrated, he puts the car in reverse, hitting Jim. He realizes what's happened, and he goes crazy. He calls Kipling, who is in his debt. Kipling arrives, and together they decide that the only way out of this unimaginable turn of events is to throw Jim into the quarry and pray the police think suicide. Kipling nodded. We hope the cops wouldn't notice the difference between injuries sustained from a car hitting you and injuries from a 300-foot fall. The police probably would have looked closer, said Martha, if not for the Masons. They were worried the business about Estella Ornato was about to be exposed. They didn't know what Jim had told people. Given the level of his anger, they probably weren't so sure Jim didn't commit suicide, having learned the truth about what they'd done. What he had done. So they stayed silent. And probably applied some pressure on that little police station. Whatever other pieces of evidence the cops unearthed, Jim's visit to Honeylove Fried Chicken, Vita's tip-off about Shrieks being the real white rabbit, cell phone records, they stopped pursuing it. The Masons confiscated the contents of Jim's case file, don't forget, said Kipling. Exactly.
But there's blood here, whispered Whitley.
She was using the light on her cell to illuminate the area where the Nissan had been parked. It wouldn't take much effort for police to see that something brutal had happened right here.
We cleaned it up, said Kipling. I noticed the blood, and we spent an hour tearing up the grass with bloodstains. I shoved it into my backpack and spent more time at school flushing it down the toilet.
There you have it, said Martha. The freak possible. There was nothing to say, nothing to do except to consider the strange history Martha had just related like a professor illuminating to her students some new law of gravity. For a while, I was aware of nothing but my own shallow breathing, and the orchestra of crickets, and the night, gasping and alive all around us. Never had I imagined a truth like this.
It's too extraordinary,
whispered Whitley, crossing her arms, shivering.
When you think about it, we all killed Jim. I sent Cannon here, and Cannon hit Jim with the car, and Kipling helped him cover it up. All of us are guilty, right? All of us except Martha and Beatrice. You're the good ones.
That's not true, I blurted, tears burning my eyes, a lump in my throat.
It's time to get out of here.
Martha whispered this, frowning thoughtfully as she stared overhead. Bewildered, none of us moved. Then she was pushing us, and I realized, stunned, looking up, that without even being aware of it, I'd been standing too close to one of the tower's steel legs, because the entire thing was tottering. The wood was groaning and splintering. Suddenly, with a thunderous moan of metal and glass, the entire lookout was tipping over, rusted nails and screws and wooden beams raining down on us as we took off across the quarry road. I threw myself into the wall of grass, fighting back blades as they slapped and whipped my face. I ducked and covered my head as the entire structure collapsed around me with a roar, Kipling and Whitley shouting somewhere behind me. I felt myself tossed forward. When I opened my eyes, I was on my stomach, the immense pressure of the ending wake pressing against my legs. I managed to heave myself onto my back, blinking up at the sky. I heard voices, and then Martha and the others were bending over me. "She's at the end of her wake," said Martha. "We don't have much time. We have to find Cannon."
"I think I know where he is," said Whitley, her face grave.
When she told us the location, no one spoke. Of all possible places in space and time, this one seemed the most frightening and the most impossible. "No," said Martha. "No way. It's too risky for B." She was helping me to my feet, pulling me toward the edge of the quarry. "We should go back to Wincroft." "We need Cannon for the vote," I said. "I'll go. I'll get him and bring him back." Martha looked anxious. But there wasn't time to argue. I could feel the wake traveling up my neck. I knew what to do. I stared down at the quarry and the lake so far below. This was the same journey Jim had made. My Jim.
"I'll see you there," I whispered.
They were watching me, afraid, but there was no time and nothing to say to reassure them. I squeezed their hands one by one. Then I jumped. Chapter 25. When I opened my eyes, I was submerged in freezing water. Milky blue liquid floated before my eyes. I kicked, barely able to feel my legs. I couldn't tell which way was the surface. My lungs throbbing in pain, I blew bubbles, watching dimly as they floated in the opposite direction of where I'd thought to go. I kicked after them into murky darkness, the water growing icier, shadowed fish circling me, their cold, gelatinous skin brushing my toes and fingertips. I wanted to scream. I kicked again. Suddenly, I breached the lake's surface, gulping in the icy air. I looked around. Dense white fog swirled everywhere, chalky and crystalline. A thin layer of ice on the pond's surface splintered around my shoulders. I dog-paddled in a circle, groping for something to hold onto, but there was nothing. It was impossible to see more than a foot ahead. Dead white tree trunks rose out of the water around me, retreating into the whiteness overhead. It was where Whitley had told us to go. Blue Pond, Cannon's birdcage, at 3:33 p.m. on his birthday last year. It was the real-life place in the photo inside the bug Cannon had discovered in Apple's operating system sophomore year at Darrow. It was a dreamlike setting of chalky mist and thin black Japanese larch and silver birch trees growing straight out of an icy blue lake. There was nothing else here.
"Cannon?"
My voice, hoarse and unsteady, ventured only a few feet in front of me before giving up. My legs were so frozen they felt unattached to me. The cold was like knives in my back,
Cannon!
A boat motor roared behind me. Startled, I turned to see the paint-chipped bow of a skiff blasting out of the fog, heading straight toward me. I caught a glimpse of faded blue words, Little Bird. Cannon hunched over the motor, his bearded face red, his hair long and matted. The boat hit my head. White pain exploded through my skull. The water silenced my shocked scream as I was dragged under. Everything went black. When I opened my eyes again, I was submerged in freezing water. It was silent. Blue water clouded my eyes. I could see debris floating around me, seaweed, bits of shell, and mud. Long, dark fish with overbites and bulging eyes drifted around me. They looked dead until I touched one and it shot into the shadows. I wasn't in pain, apart from my lungs. I blew bubbles, kicking after them. Within seconds, I had blasted through the surface, gasping. It was the exact same scene, the blue pond, Cannon's birdcage. A motor grunted. I whipped around to see the skiff heading for me again. I dove back down into the water, madly kicking through the explosion of bubbles as the boat missed my head by inches. My left foot burst with pain as the propeller's blade sliced it. When I resurfaced, Cannon had circled the boat around and was aiming for me again. I dove under again, swimming away a few feet before coming up for air.
Cannon, please, just wait a minute.
You shouldn't have come here, Beatrice.
We need to talk.
There's nothing to say.
What about Jim?
He scowled at the mention of the name, killing the engine.
Cannon, please, I just want to talk to you.
I held out my hand. He leaned over the boat, smiling reluctantly, extending his hand to help me aboard. As I grabbed it, however, he pulled an oar out and struck me with it on the side of the head, my vision exploding into whiteness. I screamed. I could feel my body sprawling, coming apart, cold water in my mouth, an oar on my back as he pushed me down. No matter how hard I fought, that oar remained on my shoulders, keeping me underwater. He was drowning me. There was no reasoning with Cannon anymore. The Neverworld had driven him mad. When I opened my eyes again, I was submerged in freezing water. The quiet was deafening. I realized with a stab of panic exactly what was happening. I was reliving the same wake over and over again. Cannon was killing me, whereupon I remained dead until I was pulled back to the wake. How long did it last? An hour? Minutes? I could hardly think. I was nauseous with fear. I had to stay calm. Trying to ignore the pain in my lungs, I kept swimming. Blinking up at the surface, I could see the underside of Cannon's boat amid large chunks of ice. He was hiding between the trees, waiting. I dove deeper, ignoring the dark fish with their flaking skin shooting around my legs. When I couldn't hold my breath any longer, I swam to the surface, trying not to make noise as I gulped down air. Cannon's boat was yards away. He didn't see me. He was standing in the skiff, looking around.
Beatrice? He called.
His voice sounded calm, even friendly.
You out here?
I ducked back under and swam away, the water growing dark and murky, the rotten roots of underwater trees, yellowed and tangled, wafting what looked like chimney soot. I could no longer feel my feet or hands. My thoughts were cloudy and strange. As I swam past the debris of a sunken skiff, the faded words, Little Bird, barely visible, I felt the pull of an undertow. I tried to fight it, but the current was too powerful. As soon as I recognized the deep, thundering drone of a waterfall, it was too late. I was plunging through the air. Spray blasted me like a fire hose. Rocks knocked my head and scraped my hands, branches clawing my face. White trees, blue sky. They flipped over me and under me. I kept waiting to hit the ground for it all to go black, but the end refused to come. I was falling, falling for what felt like an hour, every inch of my body freezing, stiffening. Then I hit a boulder. Life left me like light from a bulb with the flip of a switch. When I opened my eyes, I was submerged in freezing water. How many times had I been here before? 4 times? 4 million? Fish swirled around me like murderous thoughts. I swam into them and they scattered. I floated deep under the water until I spotted his boat. The water was getting colder. A thin layer of ice was forming on the surface, growing thicker by the minute. I could see Cannon searching for me. Grabbing a submerged piece of driftwood, I swam directly underneath the hull, clinging there, breathing through a hole in the ice around the boat's edge. I yanked off my pink t-shirt and let it drift to the other side. Cannon, thinking it was me, bent over to pull it out. And as he did, I surfaced and jammed the wood in his back as hard as I could. He cried out in surprise, pitching forward, losing his balance, somersaulting through the ice. I climbed into the boat, nearly capsizing it. I yanked the cord to start the engine. I pried off Cannon's hands gripping the side and veered the boat away.
"Beatrice!" he howled, waving at me. "Come back!"
I ignored him. His old gray hoodie and a red flannel blanket were folded up around a thermos in the hull. I yanked on the sweater, wrapped the blanket around my shoulders. I unscrewed the thermos and drank. It was tea, so hot it scalded my mouth. I drove on. It was impossible to see where I was going. The fog disclosed only inches of the world at a time. Blue water, driftwood, blackened tree trunks. They appeared suddenly, ramming the sides of the boat, causing the engine to stall. After a while, I could hear the deafening roar of the waterfall and Cannon far behind me. He was crying.
"I'm freezing. I'm going to die here. Help me, Beatrice."
I wasn't sure how far I'd gone when I spotted a coil of long, blonde hair under the ice, ice at least 3 inches thick. I smashed it with the oar, realizing in shock that it was Whitley floating there. She was barely conscious. A few feet away, trapped under the ice, were Martha and Kipling. One by one, I heaved them into the boat. They were half-dead, heads lolling. I placed them in the stern, pulled off their boots and jeans and t-shirts, pulled the blanket over their legs to get them warm, poured tea into their mouths. Soon they showed signs of life.
"What is happening?" asked Martha.
I told her. She asked to see Cannon, so I turned the boat back, steering between the trees until we stumbled upon him. He was clinging to a trunk, so much ice encrusting his beard it was completely white. He was dead. His lips were blue. He had pulled off all his clothes.
"His wake must be years if his hair is this long," whispered Martha, touching a frozen strand.
She turned to me. "We have to keep at this, but next time, keep him alive. It's up to you, Bea. We don't arrive in time. So get control of the boat, restrain him, but keep him alive until we get here. Then we can vote."
Cannon's not himself anymore. How can he vote?
I wanted to ask this, only I realized as the boat jerked backward suddenly that we were getting pulled into the waterfall. I grabbed the oar, trying to fight it. Martha grabbed the other paddle. Whitley tried to grab hold of passing tree trunks to stop us. Kipling could only stare out at the fog, petrified. It was futile, of course. In less than a minute, the skiff was swinging into the throes of the current, water pounding us. We were rocketing past boulders, ricocheting against trees, overturning into the whiteout. The last thing I saw was Whitley reaching out to try to grab my hand as the boat fell out from under us and we fell. The vote. The vote. The vote. How long did it all go on? The fight for the skiff. Cannon's rescue. Binding his ankles and wrists. Hauling my friends out of the ice. I did it over and over again in the freezing cold, trying not to drown. I tried different tactics every time. Cannon might have been half mad, but he was on to me. He was a strange, terrifying foe, at times vicious, other times childlike. He was the worst person to have to capture alive because I knew him from before. There were times when he was his old self again, funny and kind and sensitive, vocal about wanting to help me, to do everything in his power to make it better. Inevitably, though, he'd cast this persona off like a Halloween costume, revealing someone upended by rage and regret. I understood then that Cannon had always lived his life with his future glory in mind, that every moment of his every day and every act of kindness had been because he was expecting that at some future date he would be somebody at last. Now that he had no future, he didn't know how to exist. He'd shout his grievances into the fog.
I was duped. Swindled. First there was the nightmare of Jim, and now this? Are you kidding me? It isn't supposed to be like this. I'm supposed to grow up. I'm supposed to have another 70 years. I never made an impression. It's like I was never even here. Was I here? Was I even here, Beatrice? Beatrice, where are you?
Sometimes, when Cannon gave me trouble, I was too late freeing the others from the ice. When I found them, they were all dead except Martha. She was always semi-conscious, deliriously whispering the same two words over and over again. It's you. After a while, I had a map of the entire Blue Lake in my head like a blind man who's memorized every inch of his neighborhood. I knew where every dead tree stood, where every boulder sat, when every spray of water would firework over the rocks into oblivion. The chance for the vote inched closer. Faster and faster I restrained Cannon. This had as much to do with his increasing fatigue, his resignation, as with my speed and resolve. I bound his hands and ankles with a yellow vine ripped from the bottom of the lake, pulling him up into the boat, leaving him sulking in the bow. Faster and faster I revived the others. The remainder of my wake was 11 minutes. 11 minutes between the time they were warm and under the blanket and the moment I rigged the boat to the trees so we wouldn't plunge into the waterfall. 11 minutes to vote.
I'm not voting, Cannon always said.
Yes, you are, said Whitley.
No.
Then you'll drown here. He laughed. I'd grown used to his mad cackle by then, but it still scared the others.
Drowning? You think I'm scared of drowning? Drowning, for me, is shaking a hand. It's saying, have a nice day. It's saying, would you like an Egg McMuffin with those hot cakes? It's saying, welcome to Home Depot. Can I help you select a weed whacker?
Please stop, whispered Whitley, trying not to cry. The vote. The vote. The vote. We had no pen and no paper. I pried a piece of splintered wood off the skiff's bottom boards, and we used that to cut the first initial of our chosen survivor into our palms. Over time, strange things began to happen in those 11 minutes. The dead trees began to topple and crash into the water, creating waves that surged and flooded the boat. The fog retreated, revealing a gray sky, clouds roiling like potion in a witch's cauldron. Swarms of red insects like the ones Martha had drawn boomeranged around us like tiny squalls of rain, emitting a high-pitched hum, colliding with our foreheads and ears and getting tangled in our hair, making us scream. A single fat fly appeared, too, buzzing around our heads. We all knew it was Pete, the imaginary friend who'd lived inside Cannon's boyhood computer, the one he'd told us about. Ice encrusted our hair and eyelashes. It thundered and snowed and hailed. In the 11th minute, the skiff even began to disintegrate under us, blue water seeping up between the beams until the wood began to blacken and crumble to mud. I understood what was happening, though I didn't say a word. No one did. It was the decision. The slow settling in on a single name. It was the death of our dreams, our youth, of possibility. There had always been hope here in the Neverworld, no matter how terrifying things got. Now even that was disappearing. Cannon ignored our entreaties to vote. He stayed slumped against the side of the boat, staring out, singing Just Like Heaven by The Cure under his breath, repeating the phrase, You, soft and lonely, over and over again. Then, one wake, he actually snatched the wood from Kipling, and gnashing his teeth in frustration, he too carved what appeared to be someone's initials into his hand. He did it rashly, blood oozing between his fingers as he collapsed back, staring out, exhausted. That was when Whitley sat up, pointing into the fog. It was the Keeper. He was rowing a boat toward us, wearing his dark suit and tie. He maneuvered alongside us. In spite of the hail, his boat jerking and bobbing against ours, the spray of water, he was remarkably dry.
"Congratulations," he shouted,
his voice scarcely audible over the thunder.
"There is a consensus."
"What?"
gasped Whitley. The Keeper only smiled, gripping the sides of the boat so as not to be tossed out. He cleared his throat, straightening his tie, though almost immediately the wind flung it back over his shoulder.
"Life does not belong to you. It is the apartment you rent. Love without fear, for love is an airplane that carries you to new lands. There is a universe in silence, a tunnel to peace in a scream. Get a good night's sleep. Laugh when you can. You are more magical than you know. Take your advice from the elderly and children. None of it is as crucial as you think, but that makes it no less vital. Our lives go on and on. Look for the breadcrumbs."
I think we were only half listening. We were all stupefied.
"It's been a pleasure."
He bowed. And just like that, he took up the oars again and rowed away. The change was immediate. The water stilled. The storm tapered off. The roar of the waterfall faded to a whisper. The sun emerged out of the blue sky, glaring and hot. In fact, the scene so quickly transformed to a calm, serene lake with shimmering water that the memory of all I'd endured these past 12 wakes, or 12 million, seemed as hazy as some half-remembered dream. It grew hot. Whitley and Kip stripped down to their underwear, and whooping and shouting, they cannonballed into the water as if it were the final hours of summer camp. Cannon, with a deadened look, threw himself headfirst over the side, and though I stood in alarm, calling out his name, he only kicked away from me on his back, his eyes closed. He seemed so tired. He seemed to want peace. That left me with Martha. I had something important to say to her, and I might never have another chance. "Martha." She was watching Whitley and Kipling laughing about something. She turned. "We've never been friends. I just want to tell you that I understand why. And it's okay." She stared at me. "I was his girlfriend. Everyone was in love with Jim. It wasn't so hard to imagine that you were too. I just wish we'd gotten to know each other better." She tilted her head, frowning.
"Jim? You think I was in love with Jim?"
I nodded. She smiled.
"I never loved Jim. It was you. What you did for me. You saved my life."
She said it faintly. I wasn't sure I'd heard her correctly. "Do you remember that night freshman year, during the snowstorm? The night of holiday dance. The power went out, and you ran back to the dorm to change your dress. You found me reading in the common room. You laughed because I hadn't noticed the window was wide open and there was a snowdrift on the carpet. You stayed and talked with me, even though Jim was waiting for you." I remembered. It was the one time we'd had a good conversation. "It wasn't an accident the window was open." I stared at her. I'd been planning it for weeks. I'd done the math. Sixth floor, Larkin Hall. A simple acceleration due to gravity across 76 feet. Even landing in a snowdrift, my chance of survival was less than 1%. I couldn't breathe. It was stupid. One of those dark spells of loneliness that I thought meant everything. Little did I know, it meant nothing. These monumental moments of our childhood, they're just one bend in the river, a tight curve filled with boulders so you can't see beyond. The river roars on across distances we can't even imagine. I was about to jump when I heard someone coming. It surprised me, so I hesitated, threw myself on the couch, grabbed some random book, pretending to read. You came in, and you saved my life. So here, in the Neverworld, I had to save yours. I opened my mouth to say something, but no sound emerged. I thought for sure you were on to me, she said, shaking her head. Like back at the Warwick police station, how I suddenly appeared downstairs with you. You knew I was the one who removed the papers from Jim's case file, right?
What? I whispered.
It wasn't the Masons. It was me. I hid the files in another box so they'd never find them. She took a deep, unsteady breath. Because it was all there. Jim's texts to you. I didn't want them to suspect you. That was why I was so against going back to Vulcanation. I didn't want them to find out the truth. So as soon as we landed, I snuck away so I could dismantle the ladder from the foreman's lookout before anyone else saw it. I climbed up 50 feet, got a million splinters, but I knew I had to present a compelling scenario with such assurance that they'd all be blind to the truth.
What?
She studied me with a soft smile. You know, Beatrice. You were there. Chills ricocheted down my spine. I saw you. Coming back from the quarry. She squeezed my hand. You have nothing to feel guilty about. Whatever happened, I know you acted with a full heart. I never doubted you. And I never will. All my blood drained into my feet. I was going to be sick. Jim loved you, but he didn't see you. He was incapable of that. You were the one to keep him propped up. You were his scaffolding. He could be riveting and addictive, and you loved him, and we rarely see those we love as they are. She sighed, hunching her shoulders. That's what killed me the most. Why I could never be your friend. Why I couldn't stay around you. You made me so mad, Bea. She shook her head, staring at me, her face a wild pool of emotion barely contained. I've seen it before. It happened to my sister. She loved a boy, and that love made her put herself last and forget herself, and it killed her. Your love was that unquestioning. It made you do things that were dangerous. That ripped me up. What are you talking about, Martha? Nowhere Man, Jim's musical. Everyone gushed about how brilliant it was, and it was. But it was strange, wasn't it? How suddenly, after weeks of whining, being unable to write a single word, Jim had it all come together on the eve of his debut at Spring Vespers. Like magic. She stared at me, her face grave. You were the magic. I was unable to speak. I felt as if a glaring light were suddenly shining into my eyes. You showed them to me the night of the snowstorm, those dream soundtracks. I never forgot them. I committed the words to heart. I recognized your voice immediately when Jim showed me what he'd written. You're my Sunday best, my new car smell, your Chateau Margaux, no Zinfandel. Martha shook her head. Jim thought nothing of passing off your words as his own. Did he say he was just borrowing them? that he'd give you credit later?
He swallowed everything around him, leaving nothing behind.
She wrinkled her nose.